You may be wondering what I know about prescription drug abuse, and I'll tell you what I do for my job. I'm a pharmacist at Woodridge Hospital, which is a psychiatric hospital here in town. I interact on pretty much a daily basis with folks who are abusing medications. And also work with Over Mountain Recovery, which is the methadone clinic in Gray. And I want to talk about a little about addiction and what it is. Most of us who have not been touched by it or have not learned a whole lot about it, it's very difficult to understand. Somebody is using a substance that's harmful to them, and so it's very tempting for us to say, well, it hurts you, just quit, just don't do it again. And that sounds like a reasonable answer to somebody who's not involved with it. Let me give you an example of addiction and dealing with that kind of thing. And if you're willing, here is an exercise to do. And I will predict the outcome and I'll be right. Okay, each one of us has some habit that we do that's not good. Call it a bad habit. So if you will, pick your habit. You know it's not good, but we do it anyway, right? Pick that habit. Stop doing it. As of right now, just stop. Don't ever do it again, ever. You can't do it. And the way it works is, and if you'll try this, you'll see. The way it works is when it's the opportunity for our bad habit to arise again, we remember. Oh, I decided I wasn't ever going to do that again, so I'm not going to do it. And so, at that moment, we don't. Because, you know, we have decided and we've made a decision and we're strong and all that. And so we've decided. And then, we do it, it happens again, and okay, maybe I feel so uncomfortable, but boy, I have decided. Next time, maybe we've had a bad day. We're tired. We're hungry. We're lonely. And then it's time for our bad habit to happen again. And we feel bad. And it's very stressful to not do our bad habit. But we say, we're not going to do it because we've decided. But we're tired and we're hungry. And we don't feel good. And then it's like, just this once and then I'll never ever do it again. And we do it. Whatever our bad habit is, we do it and suddenly there is a wave of relief. The stress of resistance is gone. Oh, and it feels so much better. For about 5 seconds until the guilt hits. Why'd I do that? It wasn't worth it. And we're ashamed and we're guilty. And so we'll never do it again. Never, ever. But you know what happens the next time. And we do this again and again and again until something big happens to make us change. That's a little thing. Now, if our bad habit is something that changes the way our brain works, it changes our brain. An addictive substance changes the way our brain functions. And in talking with people who have been abusing medications or addicted to them, it seems like, and in talking with them, it seems like some of them get to a point where if it's easy to make the right decision and easy to make the wrong decision, and equally easy to make good decisions or bad decisions, they choose the bad one. Doesn't make sense. But that's the point we get to. And it's an addiction. I'll talk about the difference between abusing something and being addicted to it. They are different. Abusing is basically like doing something stupid. You know, I want to do this, and so that's an abuse. An addiction is, I can't live without it. You just saw on the video, some of the people were talking about stealing. A person who is addicted will steal from their parents, will steal from their friends, just to support the habit. They will do anything. It takes over. Looking at medications, we think of, I look at medications as tools. A tool, you know, if you need to, you know, turn a screw in the wall or something, you get a screwdriver. And I see medication as tools to help us accomplish things. And think about things like oxycodone and hydrocodone, fentanyl, whatever it might be. It's a tool. Is it good or is it bad? Well, depends. A hammer is a tool. Is a hammer good or bad? Hammer is a wonderful thing. You can drive nails and crack open walnuts and smash your finger and hit people in the head with it. So it's the way we use the tools that makes them helpful or not helpful. And prescription medications that are abusable can be extremely helpful when used in a proper context. But when used out of context, they can be extremely, extremely harmful. The harm is in the addiction that drives people to do all kinds of things that are harmful to themselves and to others. And it often can lead to death, not always, but it can lead to death because many of these medications will make people stop breathing. So the psalmist says that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And that's, I believe it's true. Notice how we work. We are all different. And for some of us, this sort of thing is, there is no appeal. You know, why would anybody want to do something like that? And others of us, it's a very real struggle. And it's something that draws us and pulls at us all the time. And as we as Christians, as we interact with people who are addicted to substances, sometimes we feel quite uncomfortable because they're different from what we perceive ourselves to be, though they're really not that different at all. And I think about Jesus and his interaction with people who were social outcasts. One point, first chapter of Mark. If you remember, there were lepers, people with leprosy were absolute outcasts of society. Jesus took pity on this man and touched him, touched a leper. We as Christians are no better than Jesus. Looking at substance abuse, looking at prescription substance abuse, which includes things like opiates and benzodiazepines, and a few other assorted things. And we wonder why is this in the news now? Why is this a big deal? You probably saw the slide that showed that at least in Tennessee, there are more people that die from drug overdoses than from car crashes. That statistic changed like 2 or 3 years ago. And we are in the I think if I recall correctly, Tennessee is like number two in substance abuse, prescription substance abuse, and only by like 0.5%. And Upper East Tennessee is the worst part of Tennessee. We have more, on a per capita basis, we have more children born with neonatal abstinence syndrome in our area than Memphis does. Neonatal abstinence syndrome is when a baby is born to a mother who is addicted to opiates. That means the baby is addicted. Not long ago, Nisswanger Children's Hospital opened a unit specifically for treating these addicted children. So if it doesn't affect us personally and individually, it affects our society. It affects Johnson City and Washington County, Sullivan County, Greene County, Hancock County. It affects us all in one way or another. I have wondered why we're so interested in opiate abuse, and this is perhaps a little off the point. The one substance that creates more devastation in our society than any other is alcohol. By far, more people are addicted to alcohol, causes more social devastation than all the other medications and substances abuse combined. We as a society have determined that substance is legal and socially acceptable. It still causes harm. But our focus at this point just happens to be on the prescription substance abuse. Now, as part of this, as part of our series, we thought it would be worthwhile to open up the thing for anybody to ask questions, make appropriate comments. We have Michael, Dan. You can ask a question to whoever, you know, just in general, or you can direct it to one of the three of us. I got them because they know a lot of stuff. So, yes, ma'am.
What part does the medical profession have to do with causing
Okay. Question was, what part does the medical profession have to play in this, and why do they keep prescribing it? The simple, well, there's multiple parts. One part is that the pain medications, the anxiolytics, medications for anxiety that are abused, are very, very useful and very, very helpful in treating what they treat. They're very effective and can be used appropriately. Now, it's been speculated, and I don't think there's universal agreement on where the problem lies. Some years ago, they were talking about pain as the fifth vital sign, and prior to that, people in hospitals were apparently not being treated adequately for painful, for whatever painful conditions were going on, and so there was a big push to treat pain, and it seems like it may have overshot, perhaps. Some of healthcare is paid for, and it's kind of going this way a little more, is paid for based on patient satisfaction. And physicians, like anybody else, want their customers to be happy. And it takes a great deal of effort, a great deal of effort, to tell someone, no, I'm not going to give you more pain pills because they're not good for you. That takes a lot of work, and it takes extra time and a lot of effort. I think most physicians do an outstanding job of dealing with this. The few that don't, I think, contribute to the issue. I don't know if that has been an adequate answer. I don't have an adequate answer. So.
What did the number say on how many people per 100 per, are affected by this?
What do the numbers say on how many people are affected by this?
One in 100, blah, blah, blah.
I don't have that in my head. Y'all have them. You have a good answer.
The only thing I would say to that, Steve, is how many people in this room have not been affected by substance abuse, including alcohol. I don't see any hands. I mean, it's, and I think that's the compelling government interest for regulation, intervention, criminal justice.
What do you mean affected? I mean, I pay more taxes to take care of some of these people, but
that's way up.
The cost of this thing, the point I guess that I was mentioning there is maybe this thing is broad, maybe it affects a lot of people. Your incarceration rates in the federal system are very high. They're very high. And with this, we've not only saw initial costs, but we see reoccurring daily costs, not only in society, but in the criminal justice system. And we seem to think about that in a court-type environment, an arrest-type environment. The detention environment is where the money is spent. When law enforcement officers are assigned a normal duty, they're taken away from those duties and assigned to a drug task force, that's a hole in your patrol. And so the cost of this thing and the effect, Steve, is I don't know that you can measure it. If you want to try to look up some of these statistics, the Drug Abuse Warning Network, DAWN, it's a reporting system that's required of major hospitals in the United States. Substance abuse entries into the ER are classified. And if a hospital meets those certain requirements, they have to report that under DAWN. It's an acronym, D-A-W. Those numbers will stagger you. ER responses based on substance abuse. Those numbers will stagger you. And we talk about, of course, the cost and the toll of human life, and that is the most important thing. But the actual financial impact, which is what Lee's mentioning here, it's grown exponentially in 10 years. It's grown exponentially. It hasn't doubled. It's exponential. It's a number that I can't, you know. So the impact on society of substance abuse in the United States would write a book that you and I cannot carry. Please.
A lot of our young people are smoking marijuana. They've been told that it's good on the medical scene. Is that the truth or is that false?
Well, chances are if you're experimenting with marijuana at that young age, which is what I have framed in my mind when you said that, it's probably not at the request of a doctor. I'm going to go ahead and say that. In marijuana, in these controlled substances in that particular arena, you're looking at tetrahydrocannabinol, THC. The science behind THC and its potency has grown phenomenally in 10 years. British Columbia dope is unreal. What the child is consuming when they light the end of that pipe or that marijuana cigarette is something wrapped in paper. They may or may not know what it is that they're ingesting or that they're taking into their system. It's something wrapped in paper that they probably got from someone else. I never, and I had a video at one time of an interface with an individual. An officer was not responding to the radio, worked with the sheriff's department. I was fairly close. I decided I would go check on him under the Hunter Bridge in Carter County. He was interfacing with someone that, if we know your name in a county, in law enforcement, that's probably not a good thing. And we probably know your, you know, like the whole name, William Joseph James Robert, but we call you Billy Joe Jim Bob. It's because we've written it on a warrant 30 times. Well, Scott was under the bridge, and Officer Johnson Sean was out with him, wouldn't answer his radio. And it was simply because Sean had left his radio off. But as I came under the bridge, I had the camera on in the cruiser. And as the individual turned around, and there was not a hostile environment by any stretch, he said, honestly, I'm not using. And you could see the fresh tracks on both sides, which meant you had just a small amount of time to respond to him. So the cost of all of this is unreal. It's unreal. I heard Eddie Kraft frame it like this one time. It will cost you more than you were willing to pay. It will take you farther than you meant to go, and it will keep you longer than you were willing to stay. And I don't know no better way of saying it other than that. I thought that was a long time ago, and I thought that was pretty strong. Needless to say, this is something that strikes kind of near and dear. One of the first interfaces I had with a substance abuser was a minor car crash in Carter County, and she simply hit a vending machine. And when I got there, she was leaving the Coke man a note apologizing for hitting the machine. I don't think she knew where she was at. And of course, she'd been driving. Something that you will do this evening at close of services with your family, I might add.
Go.
Could you get Mike to give us examples of offenders in the court system and just what it does to their records as far as life?
Yeah, I'm going to mention something about the younger people using marijuana. If a person uses it in their teenage years, it doubles the risk of them developing schizophrenia, and it's makes them seven times more likely to become addicted to marijuana. This is from the CDC. So.
What was the question, Ken? Again?
Mike, you have an offender that's caught in your court system.
Well, if you're talking about the drug-addicted people that come through the court system, it doesn't always show up as drugs at first. Lots of times it shows up as thefts, multiple thefts. The repeat offenders that are on probation, and they get told to, you know, stay out of Walmart, stay out of various stores, and then they just go back, and they go back, and they go back, get caught over and over again. And so they build that record. They end up doing a lot of time because most everyone starts out with probation. And I always tell people, what's the worst offense you can possibly commit criminally, which is the first one. The first one is the worst one you can commit, because after that, everybody always looks at you with a skewed viewpoint, and you say, well, I didn't do it, and the police roll up, and you're standing there, and they start laughing because they've known you, they know your record, and they know your credibility is shot. So I always tell kids, especially when they come to visit the courthouse, the worst crime you can commit is the first one. You can get one expunged in Tennessee on certain crimes, but that's only one. And the abuser and the addict can't stop at one. And so then they build their record. Eventually it leads to local jail time, and it could lead to prison time. And if you're in it big enough, you go down to Greenville, and the feds have unlimited amounts of money that they can house you for the rest of your life, and sometimes they do it. Unlike the local jail here, who likes to kick you out as soon as they possibly can, so they don't have to feed you anymore. The feds have unlimited resources, yeah. The question is, what happens to the kids, and what's the cost, I guess, on the families and the children involved in the system? There's no way, like Dan said, to put a number on that. I know East Tennessee has one of the highest rates, as Steve said, in the nation for drug-addicted babies. I read a statistic the other day of the 25 worst cities for opioid distribution. Johnson City, now this is a statistic from an article sometime back last year, but Johnson City was number 6 out of 25 of the worst cities in the United States for opioid distribution. We are the epicenter here. We are the hub. The kids pay for it in the fact that the people that come through our system, of course, can't take care of their kids, and often lose the rights to the kids. And then you got the system as far as DCS having to foot the bill for that. It's kind of getting back to what Steve said. Society has somehow decided that we're going to deal with alcohol, we're going to live with alcohol. We've tried the abstinence before, and apparently we thought that didn't work. So now you and I foot the bill to maintain the alcohol industry, and we're doing the same thing for all the other drugs as well. If my personal opinion is, if the alcohol industry had to foot the bill for emergency room visits, the broken homes, the kids in the hospital, and all that, then they couldn't survive. If you laid that bill at the feet of the alcohol industry, there's no way they could pay that bill. So you and I, the taxpayer, are subsidizing the alcohol industry. I wanted to say a little bit about the marijuana issue. I'm on the drug court for Washington County's recovery court. I sit on that panel, and we see a lot of people who come to us when they're very, very desperate. They got a lot of time over their heads, and they've suddenly decided it's do all this time or maybe make a change in their life. So they try to make a change with our drug court. A lot of them do. A lot of them are successful, and we're very proud of those. I can say about marijuana, a lot of people claim it's innocent, it's non-addictive, it doesn't hurt anybody, what's the problem, let's make it legal. Probably 99% up of people, let me say, 99% probably the people that came through drug court, you go and read their bio and their history when they're applying to enter drug court, started with their first drug was marijuana. Now, not everybody that uses marijuana goes on to harder stuff. But everybody, 99% probably, that are on harder stuff started the marijuana. Dan, do you see that? You think it's true?
Yes.
They started with marijuana when they were 12, 14, or something like that. Yeah, Cheryl, you had something?
You know, you use the word society, Michael. I think we talk about this and talk about this, we look and we see, you know, and it just, why can't people see what the problem is? We want to keep talking about Band-Aids instead of a fix to the problem. And what I see here is the progressive movement of this country has so deprogrammed these young people. They do not have a fence to lean on, you know, to keep them on course. And you know, people are going to church. More and more people know less and less about the Word of God, you know. And this is our problem. As we drift further from God, we're going to have these problems. And these people want to bar mentioning of God in schools and promote everything that's vile, filthy, you know. This is what's causing these problems that we're dealing with today. When I was growing up, my dad, there was five of us boys in the family, and he told us, he said, I want to tell you guys right now, two places I better never catch. That was a beer joint and a pool hall, and we knew he meant it, you know? And so there was that fence. And then, if you know, some of this comes over to the young people. God gave you a brain, use it. Use it. Part of this monkey is on you, you know. Use this. And when you see these people out of their minds, laying out on the streets, I mean, isn't that a deterrent to keep you from wanting to get into this kind of thing? You know, we want to blame everybody else for our problems, but we've got some responsibility ourselves. And I think that, you know, until we go back and put God in the school systems, and you can say it as freely as you can say marijuana, you know, we can keep talking about these problems, and they're going to keep getting worse and worse until we get back to the first principles of this thing and bring that family unit back in being. The family unit's just been destroyed. Kids don't know, kids will come to you and say, well, I've got two mamas, you know, or I've got two daddies, and we wonder what's wrong.
Well, I think what Cheryl's saying here, that we've got the oasis and we've got the answer here in God's word. The devil's been very good at taking God out of society and out of schools and so forth. Should I? Steve says it's time to quit. There's hands up. What should I do? This is apparently an interesting topic to people. I'll leave it with Steve if he wants to take your quit.
I'll be here. To keep on schedule, we'll need to stop this at this point and have our devotional and all. We can continue the discussion afterward if you like, and we'll, Michael and I'll speak for Dan, and we'll all be glad to continue the discussion. Our next session like this will be on February 11th, and we'll have two speakers that evening, and one of them is not me, so. We'll be glad for that. So, all right, and now Steve's going to lead us in a song.